Good morning, everybody. It is Sunday. That's no surprise. What are we at now? January 21st?
Yes.
And we're in John 21. The days are closing down on us here. I honestly think that we'll finish this next week, which is exactly the minimum amount of time the pastor asked me to give him before he stepped in for me. And I wouldn't have minded going an extra week or two beyond that, but it's just not how it's falling out. So be it. So we'll finish today, next week, then I'll take a little bit of a break, and pastor will step in and do something. I'm not 100% sure what, even, but I think I know what it's probably going to be. But yeah.
It's not on.
Now it is.
Oh, now it is.
Okay. And I'll be back in September. I know myself well enough to know that this has been true everywhere I've been in my life. I cannot not teach. I don't know what a calling is for anybody else, but that's what it is for me. I can't not do it. It finds me everywhere I go. It found me in high school. It found me when I was a boat builder between college and seminary. A boat builder, for crying out loud. And sure enough, I ended up teaching other people how to do the things that I was doing in the boat building process. Teaching finds me. So I surrendered myself long ago to that reality, even embrace it. But I've been doing this for 8 or 9 years, and I need a little bit more of a break than just the summer. So, with your indulgence, for both me and Pastor Vern, he'll step in here for the last couple of months of this Bible class year. But first, let's finish John. We are in chapter 21, and I think the way I'd like to do this, I wrestled with this all week, I'd like to finish the surface stuff, as it were, today, go through the story as it finishes out in chapter 21, and then go back up to a 25,000-foot level and look back, because there are some things I would change now that I've been through John and have taught it. I've said before, so many of you I'm sure will remember, one of the things I love about doing this is how much I learn. That's my motivation. That's most of my joy in it. 2/3 of the stuff I walk in here with any given Sunday, I didn't know the Sunday before. So I'm learning, too, and then just passing on what I'm discovering. And there are things I've discovered in the course of teaching John for a year and a half that make me look back and say, yeah, you know what, if I were to do it over, I'd change a few things. So we'll talk about that a little bit today, too. Not that there'll be any surprises. You've been with me for the ride. And again, I want to talk a little bit about why John wrote this. Because we talked, you know, you always start out teaching a book of the Bible. You talk about the basic who, what, when, where, why questions. And I don't know if you remember this, and some of you weren't even here a year and a half ago when we started this, but we left out the why, and we left out the when. And I've touched on those here and there along the way, but I want to make sure that I touch on those now. Chapter 21 is a major reason for me waiting on those questions. Okay, so we got into chapter 21 last week already. This is post-resurrection stuff. We already had some in chapter 20, which John ends with a statement about the purpose of the book that looks a lot like the end of the book. Chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. A lot of scholars, and I have been among them, see that as the original ending of the book. And chapter 21 is something that was added on later, not by somebody else, still by John, but before the book was sent out for some reason or other. And my thought has always been, and it's not my thought originally, a lot of people think this, that the occasion was Peter's death. One of the things that has changed in my view, and I'll get into this next week more, is that I don't think this was an afterthought. Chapter 21 is an epilogue, yes, but it was always there. I've changed my view on that. I think it was always there. There are structural things inside here, again, that we'll look at next week, that counterbalance it over against the prologue in chapter 1. And that kind of symmetry doesn't make any sense if half of it wasn't there originally. So we'll get to that next week. I do, however, still think that the occasion here is Peter's death. That has not changed in my view. John is almost certainly writing this from Ephesus. We don't have biblical evidence for this, but we have strong early church historian and tradition evidence for this. There is decent, not fabulous, but decent patristic evidence that John left Jerusalem in the year AD 65 or so and headed to Ephesus, where he would have been working from what was one of Paul's major centers of operation. It is speculative, but it would make a lot of sense, and that's as much as we can say about it, if the reason for John heading up there was Paul's death. The timing would be right. We know that Paul and Peter died during the reign of Emperor Nero. We don't know exactly when, but the dates for Paul run anywhere from 64 to 67. The dates for Peter run anywhere from 65 to 68. They usually tend to run toward the higher end of those numbers. Nero committed suicide on June 9th in the year AD 68. So if Paul and Peter died under Nero's reign, then they died before June of 68. And it's more likely that they died within maybe 1 year of each other than that they died within 4 years of each other. But that's all circumstantial evidence, and it's important to note that. Nor is it vital that we understand exactly how that works out. But it does fit if John headed up to Ephesus because of the death of Paul and became a leader in the church up there in that area to provide continuity of leadership in one of the most important areas of the early church. All of the work Paul had done in Asia Minor and in Greece and in Rome to give some apostolic continuity to what was happening up there in the church would have been extremely important. There is also some internal evidence that John's gospel was written earlier than a lot of scholars want to say it was. A lot of scholars want to see John's gospel as being the last one written. Excuse me. And I still think that may be true. I just don't think it was written as late as some say. Some want to see it as being written almost as late as the book of Revelation, which is dated around maybe 90, when John was an old man and in exile on the island of Patmos. But I think the gospel was written earlier, and some of the reasons for that are these. First of all, John talks about things in Jerusalem and in the terrain around Jerusalem in terms and descriptions that were only true before the destruction of the temple. For example, he says, now there is a pool at Siloam, present tense. But after the destruction of Jerusalem, that pool wasn't there anymore. Some of the things he talks about in terms of the terrain around Jerusalem were things that changed. He is the only gospel writer who does not talk about Jesus. I need to say this carefully. John talks about Jesus' prophecy regarding destroy this temple and I will raise it in 3 days. That comes out early in John's gospel. But Jesus' statement that do you see these stones, not one of them will be left standing on another, that's not in John. Now, that's not the strongest piece of evidence there could possibly be because 90% of John is unique. There's lots of things John doesn't say, and sometimes it seems like he doesn't say them because he assumes his audience has already read at least one of the other Gospels. So that's not a very strong piece of evidence, but it does nevertheless go on the scales. That would be a pretty significant thing, especially for somebody steeped in Judaism the way John clearly is, to not mention the destruction of the temple. But if he wrote before the destruction of the temple, if he left Jerusalem in AD 65 and wrote his gospel around that time because of the deaths of Paul and Peter, both of which happened before the destruction of the temple, it would make sense. And if you think about John being in Ephesus, which we're very confident about, and leading the church in the generation after Paul's death, which we're very confident about, who were the primary players in that area before John came in? Well, Paul, obviously, but also Peter. Peter had become a leader in the church at Rome, the first pope in the Roman Catholic tradition, and whatever disagreements you may have with the Roman Catholic tradition or their version of history, the argument that Peter was a leader in the church at Rome is not disputable. He was. So Peter and Paul have both been there, have both been critical figures there. And if I'm right about the timing, they've both just died. Think about what that means for a church in its first generation of existence. Because we're only talking about 35, give or take, years after the crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus. The church is only a generation old. And when you lose two major leaders, guys with skin on, so to speak, not to minimize the imminent presence of Christ with his church, but he's in heaven. Yes, with skin on, but he's in heaven. Peter is right there. Paul was right there. They're gone. This is a church that could very well use some reassurance. And I think John's gospel was written to that part of the world first and foremost, to give them some assurance with the loss of two key leaders. Not just two key leaders for that area, certainly that, but two key leaders for Christendom in general. That it should happen, that it should be occasioned by Paul's death is not as clearly evidenced in the text to reach in and say, yeah, look at this verse, look at this verse. We can see why this is tied into Paul. But it is easier to do that with Peter. And we're going to see that as we get into these verses later in chapter 21. So chapter 21 is really all one scene. It happens all in one day, a night and a day, technically, because they start out going fishing on the Sea of Tiberias. And they fish all night long, and they catch nothing. And we looked at that last week in verse 4, just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore. They didn't recognize him. We find out later it's about 100 yards away. Well, I'm not sure who I'd recognize at the opposite goal line either. But after 3 years with a guy, I don't know. Do you have any fish? No. Cast your net on the other side and you'll find some. So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. And I want to repeat the point that we made last week to emphasize this. This is in many ways a reenactment of the story from Luke chapter 5, very early in Jesus' ministry, when he was calling disciples. And I don't think that's a coincidence, because what's going to happen here today is all about Peter. John 21, Luke 5 is the calling of Peter, not just Peter. John 21 is the recalling of Peter. This is a restoration of Peter, who needs restoration because he denied his Lord when it mattered most. And it's clear from this story that that was an issue for him. So all of this in John 21, up to this point, where this stranger on the shore tells them, cast your net somewhere else, and, oh my goodness, now we've got so many fish we can't pull the net in. That's all happened before. That all happened when Peter was first called. And so there is an event here to be recognized. And the parallels are important, I think, for Peter, if not in the moment, then at least later, to realize that this is Jesus reenacted my call in order to assure me of my forgiveness and my restoration to the mission that he called me to. Peter is not the one, however, upon whom this whole thing first dawns. That's John, who was also there in Luke 5. James and John and Peter seem to kind of be a little fishing enterprise unto themselves, sometimes with others around them, sometimes not. So verse 7 here of chapter 21, that disciple whom Jesus loved therefore said to Peter, it's the Lord. John is the one who first realizes that's Jesus on the shore. When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, threw himself into the sea, and it's implicit at this point and clearer later, heads for shore. The other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, about 100 yards off. And it may have been too much to pull it into the boat, but they could at least haul it along. Back in Luke 5, it took two boats with the net between them to deal with how much fish they had caught. When they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid out on it and bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish you've just caught. So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. I'll deal with 153 next week. Why is that significant? I've had a couple of you ask me since last week and have expressed a very, very definite interest in this. I'm sorry to put you off a week. But I think this is the better way for us to approach all of this. And if I get into it now, I'll never finish what I need to finish in terms of the story itself. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. I also wonder whether or not this is not meant to remind them of another time when Jesus had bread and fish and made sure that there was more than enough for everybody who was there. That happened in John and all the others. It's one of the few stories that's in all of the Gospels, the feeding of the 5,000. Jesus is known to be able to work with bread and fish. Now, none of the disciples dared ask him, I'm in verse 12, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. Well, it's the third time in John. There are other instances in the other Gospels, and I think Luke is the one who says that it actually happened a number of times, and he appeared to this many once, and he appeared to that many once. Now, verse 15, when they had finished breakfast, so we're still in the same scene, Jesus said to Simon Peter, and by the way, just when you picture this in your mind, at some point in all of this, although it doesn't say it until several verses later after the fact, it looks like Jesus and Peter go for a little walk. Peter, walk with me down the beach. But the text doesn't tell us that. We just find out later that John was following them. When they had finished breakfast, Simon, son of John, "Do you love me more than these?" By the way, Simon, son of John, can I just make a side comment that has really nothing to do with the text? It makes me smile to stop and think that if you anglicize the name here, then one of the most important leaders in the church was Peter Johnson. Just doesn't quite have the same oomph, does it? It's like the Italian, Dave Fletcher and I were talking about opera just a tiny bit before class. Giuseppe Verdi. What a wonderful, classy name. It's Joe Green. Meanwhile, back at the story. Simon Peter said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." Notice he doesn't say, "Feed my lambs" again. He says, "Tend my sheep." He never says the same thing twice here. He'll say, "Feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep." Never quite the same thing each time. Is it important? I have no idea. I don't think so. I think what's important here is Peter. And trying to read too much into the variation in language, I think, is not fruitful. It distracts. Which will be a problem next week when we have to fight the urge to read too much into the numbers. But that's next week. He said to him the third time, verse 17, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said it to them the third time. "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep." So three times Peter had denied Jesus. Three times Jesus gives him a chance to recant that denial. It is a restoration of Peter for what happened on the night of Jesus' arrest. And then Jesus goes on to say something else. Verse 18, "Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go." And then John explains that in verse 19. This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, Jesus said to Peter, "Follow me," which brings us back to the point that we had visually at the beginning of this story, the reenactment of the original call in Luke 5. And Jesus ends all of this by saying to Peter what he said to him back then, "Follow me." This is a fresh start, Peter. I am entrusting you with everything I ever entrusted you with. Let go of what happened the night I was arrested. You're still called. You're still chosen. You still have the same mission. Follow me. But I do have to believe that one of the reasons why John puts in what he does in verses 18 and 19 is because Peter has just recently died, as John writes this. So the church in Rome and Greece and Asia Minor knows what has happened to Peter. And by putting this in, John is connecting to it. Peter didn't die young. He wasn't the youngest of the apostles in the first place. John was. He lived another 35 years or so after the close of the Gospels. Had a good long ministry career. But there came a point in time where he was being led where he did not want to go. And that was to his death. Tradition, and that's all we have for this, tradition says that Peter was crucified. The church father Origen tells us that Peter did not consider himself worthy to suffer the same death as his Lord, and so he, at his own request, he was crucified upside down. I don't know the physiology of being crucified upside down, and I'm not sure that I want to. I don't know if it actually works. If it does, I don't want to know how it actually works. It's bad enough when you're right side up. So I don't know what to make of that little piece of patristic tradition. Was Peter really crucified upside down? We do not know. But I'm not uncomfortable at all with the suggestion that he was crucified. Paul, on the other hand, we have a consistent tradition, not just from the church fathers, but also from early church historians like Eusebius, who's a major source of information for this kind of stuff, and Justin Martyr, that Paul was beheaded. And that also makes sense, because Paul would never have been crucified. Why? Because he was a Roman citizen. Right. So Paul would never have been crucified. It was swift and, as executions go, merciful if you were a Roman citizen. All right. Now in verse 20, we're still on the beach. It's still that same morning after the night of fruitless fishing. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, which would explain why John can tell this whole story, because he trailed along. He tagged along. The one who also had leaned back against Jesus during the supper and had said, "Lord, who is it that's going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, "Lord, what about this man?" Now, this again seems a little odd, but I think it makes perfect sense if we place this into the setting of Peter and Paul having just recently been killed. Jesus said to him in verse 22, "If it's my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." And then verse 23, John goes on, so the saying spread abroad among the brothers, the early church, that this disciple was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but rather, if it is my will that he remain until I come. And then your English Bible almost certainly finishes the thought, what is that to you? That probably was not in the original text. They add it because it finishes the sentence grammatically, but doesn't really matter. John's emphasis is on the if. Jesus wasn't saying that John would never die. He said, if it is my will that he remain until I come. He didn't say it was his will. It seems like a much less cryptic couple of verses if we think about it in terms of John writing to this part of Christendom that has just lost two key leaders. And he's telling them, it happens. It happens. Maybe we all thought that the Lord would come back in our lifetimes, but we're finding out that that's not the case. Paul's gone. Peter's gone. Don't assume just because of things that you might have heard from old rumors that I'm not going to be gone too. Someday I might be gone. I think that's what John is saying here. Jesus never said I wouldn't die. He was just making the point to Peter that that wasn't something for Peter to worry about. Peter needed to follow Jesus. I need to follow Jesus. All of you who are reading this gospel, you need to follow Jesus. That's the point. Don't worry about the rest of it. And then verse 24, John says a little bit more. This is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things and who has written these things. And we know that his testimony is true. I was there. And then verse 25, sort of the second summary, the second closing. Now there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. Ain't no library big enough. The world is not enough. Hey, that'd be the good title for a movie. Oh, wait, it is the title of a movie. Never mind. James Bond joke there. Don't worry about it if you don't get it. And I said this last week. I'll repeat it now. It's easy to look at the end of chapter 20. Now, there are many other signs that Jesus did. And the end here of chapter 21, there are many other things that Jesus did. And just see them as, well, okay, he was originally ending the book there at 20. Now he just brings that ending back in, not quite in the same words. But there's another very valid way to look at it, and that is that John's point is, at the end of chapter 20, this is the end of the signs. Seven signs that John brought into his story, all with the intention of demonstrating that Jesus is the Christ, that he is the Messiah. Lots of other miracles, many of them in the other Gospels. John doesn't do that. He limits himself to seven. And the end of chapter 20 is the end of that long section, the vast majority of the book, where he goes through those seven signs. Each of them inside a section of the book that is associated with a feast. So seven sections of the book focused on seven feasts, each with one of seven signs demonstrating Jesus' messiahship. That's what John has been doing since after the prologue. And at the end of chapter 20, that part's done. These are the signs that he did. He did a lot of others, but these are the signs that I'm putting in front of you. And now at the end of 21, it's more general than that. It's not just the many other signs, it's many other things. And John's really careful about his language there. He's the only one who calls them signs, which is its own word in Greek. He doesn't call them wonders. He doesn't call them miracles. Other gospel writers do. And Luke uses that kind of terminology when he moves into Acts and the miracles and wonders done by the apostles, but John calls them signs. So he's being very deliberate about his language. And I think that's what's happening here. The end of chapter 21 is not just a repeated conclusion. The end of 21 is a little different, but deliberately so, because now it is ending the book. But the end of chapter 20 ended the section of signs. So, that actually touches on the first of a few things that I would do differently if we were starting the class now, 18 months after we did. Scholars and commentators for centuries have talked about John in terms of two large divisions, the book of signs and the book of glory. And I put that division up there on this board, and it stayed on this board for months and months and months and months and months, which in the recent history of this church is its own miracle. But I won't call it a sign. Until finally I got some isopropyl alcohol and came in here and washed it off, because it was really, really bonded onto this whiteboard. It wouldn't come off by itself at that point. But I've written some verses up here today, and they're not unusual. There's a couple of slight tweaks on where I would divide the book's sections, but these are the sections. But I would not make the distinction anymore between the book of signs and the book of glory. Because the book of signs, well, a couple of things are going on. The book of signs is the ministry of Jesus up through the resurrection of Lazarus. And the book of glory is essentially the passion narrative, starting around the beginning of chapter 12. I've got it marked here as 11:55. That's where the division is usually made between the book of signs and the book of glory. Part of the reason for that is just that the passion narrative, commentators feel, deserves its own treatment. I mean, it's half the book, and I understand that. Part of it also is that many commentators see the seven signs as all being done in those first six sections. And let me get the... I'll fade a little bit on the recording for the web, but not too badly when I step over here to the board. But let me get the pieces of this written out so that it's a little clearer. 1 through 18 is the prologue. And while I have this marker out, way down at the bottom, 20, 30... through 21:25, if you can see this low on the board, is the epilogue. And in between are the seven sections that are tied to feasts. At 1:19 through 2:11, the feast is a wedding. We had a debate early on about whether that should be counted as one of the feasts. I would count it. Then 2:12 through 4:54 is a Passover, the first of three in John. Chapter 5 is a section unto itself. That was a Sabbath. I'm going to put that in square brackets because technically John never tells us what feast it is. But the default feast, if you were just talking about a feast in Judaism, would have been a Sabbath. And what happens in that section? You've got the lame man healed at the pool on a Sabbath. Sabbath is all over chapter 5. Sabbath, Sabbath, Sabbath. Chapter 6, another section unto itself, is the second Passover that John deals with. Then we have the Feast of Tabernacles in chapter 7 through most of 10. Then in 10 and 11, we have the Feast of Dedication. And then what most scholars call the Book of Glory, I would consider something the seventh feast section, which is the third of the three Passovers that John puts in here. So I no longer look at the book as having this big division in the middle between the Book of Signs and the Book of Glory. But one of the reasons why people make that division historically is that they see the seven signs as happening in these first six sections. Well, isn't there a sign in that final Passover section? There's certainly a miracle. Jesus rises from the dead. But is that a sign for John? I'm going to draw this out because people in the back are craning around trying to find it. Hopefully that helps a little bit. You know, you could consider this catch of fish in John 21 to be something of a miracle. But John does not call it a sign. And in fact, he's already closed off the section of signs with what he has to say at the end of chapter 20. So in terms of determining what is a sign and what isn't, if John is so careful with his language, then I'd like to look at what John has to say. What is John's list of the seven signs? And I'm going to suggest that it's not what historically many have said it was. So I got to peel this back just a little to be able to step over there again. And you can fill this out with me, right? This will be good review. The wedding feast at Cana, what was the miracle? What was the sign? Water turned to wine. Water to wine. Does John call that a sign? He sure does. He explicitly says at the end of the story, this, the first sign that Jesus performed, happened at Cana of Galilee. That's in chapter 2, verse 11, right at the end of the whole thing. So there's our first sign. Chapters 2, 3, and 4, the first Passover. There's a lot in this section. The whole conversation with Nicodemus is here in chapter 3. The woman at the well. In chapter 4, might even argue that there's something of a miracle there because he knows so much about her, but John doesn't call that a sign. What does he call a sign in that section? Anybody remember? I don't blame you if you don't remember. He heals the official's son. Remotely. From a distance. It's the last thing that happens in that section. And John expressly calls it the second sign. And again, he does so in the very last verse, 4:54. Chapter 5, the Sabbath, I gave you this one. He heals the man by the pool. heals the lame man at the pool. Does John call that a sign? Sure he does. Interestingly enough, though, he doesn't call it a sign inside these verses. But he refers to it in 6 verse 2 when he says that people were responding to all the signs that Jesus was doing with the sick and infirm, which is a clear reference back to, among other things, this. So 6:2 is where John calls that one a sign. Then chapter 6, the Passover, the miracle here, he feeds the 5,000. This is the interesting one where I depart from a lot of commentators. He feeds the 5,000, but he does something else. He walks on water. So isn't that two things? Well, what does John call them? Well, he talks about the sign, specifically referring to the feeding of the 5,000, at 6:14. But he also talks at 6:26 about the signs that Jesus was doing. And I'm not doing this just to make everything sort of fit my paradigm. But I really think that John is treating these as a single event. Oh, I see how my handwriting is starting to slide off the cliff there. Keep in mind what each one of these sections and what each one of these feasts and what each one of these signs is revealing about the Messiah. What it's revealing about Jesus as the Messiah. The water to wine at the wedding. Jesus is bringing in the promised final marriage feast of the Lamb. The fancy church word, eschatological marriage feast of the Lamb. The feast that God's people will enjoy with him in the age to come. Jesus turns water into wine, and you get the whole five jars thing and some Torah symbolism in the water jars too. But he's demonstrating that he is the one who brings that age to come feast into this time and place. In the first Passover, with what he says to Nicodemus, with what he has to say to the woman, the healing of the official's son, it's a little harder to find a single strand there, but it's there to be found. Jesus is demonstrating himself to be the new locus of God's presence among his people. Jesus is the new temple. The temple that is the source of healing for the final Sabbath, the age to come. And so the healing of the official son, and implicitly from what it says in John 6, 2, others that John doesn't specify, makes sense there. Chapter 5 in the Sabbath, healing the lame man. Jesus is the one who brings about, invading into this time and place, that age to come Sabbath that will last forever, where everyone is restored to be able to enjoy fully the presence of God and life in his presence. Chapter 6, another Passover. This is the one where Jesus shows himself to be, and this is kind of a big one, Jesus shows himself to be the God who led his people through the Red Sea and fed them in the wilderness. This is the one where Jesus shows himself to be the Lord of the waters, and the one who can provide food for his people. And when you realize those parallels, which are pretty obvious to the Exodus, the reason I say this is kind of a big one is because it's pretty direct. There aren't as many dots to connect. Jesus is demonstrating himself to be Yahweh. That's a big one. That's true in all of them, but that one is just a much straighter line. And I think the feeding of the 5,000 and the walking on the water, John is looking at as a single thing, because it is a single demonstration of Jesus as the God of the Exodus. Tabernacles, he heals the man born blind. And is that a sign? Yes, it is. In 9:16, John refers to that as a sign. Chapters 10 and 11, the Feast of Dedication. What's the sign? It's one of the big ones. No? Raising of Lazarus. He raises Lazarus from the dead. That is not called a sign until chapter 12, verse 18. So that one looks backward a little bit, just as 6:2 did, and says, yes, that was a sign. And then the most interesting of all, and you see why people say, well, that's the seven signs, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I'm conflating the feeding of the 5,000 and the walking on the water, and I'm not the only one to do that. But if those are considered one thing for John's purposes, and it certainly fits the structure and it certainly fits the themes, then what's the seventh sign? The seventh sign is the resurrection of Jesus himself. But where does John call that a sign? That's the really interesting question. And I'm not going to set you loose here with 10 minutes or less to go, to go hunting through 10 chapters of John to try to find it. I will tell you where it is, but it's not where you think. This is the resurrection of Jesus. And it is called a sign in John 2, verses 18 and 19. Which means that where we had a couple of them were looking backwards, this is one that is very much looking forward. Seriously? That section doesn't begin until John 11, and I'm saying it's called a sign in John 2? We have to look at that one. Jump back to John 2. Verses 18 and 19. He's in the temple, overturns the tables. So the Jewish leadership says to him in verse 18, what sign do you show us for doing these things? They want to know what authority he has to do this. And they actually give us the terminology, sign. Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. They said, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you'll raise it up in 3 days. But he was speaking about the temple of his body. When, therefore, he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. Yes, this is the seventh sign, even though it is only called a sign. 17 chapters, 18 chapters before it finally happens. But in John's careful use of the word semeion, which means sign, it's one of the signs. Seven sections, seven feasts, seven signs that are called signs. And they actually align quite nicely. That's how I see the structure of John now that I've taught my way through it. A little bit different, but not a lot different. It's nothing terribly novel. If any of you have a Roman Catholic background, happen to own a Jerusalem Bible, this is exactly how the Jerusalem Bible editors see the structure of the book. I found that out last night, poking around a little bit, knowing I wasn't the first. And of course, there are other sevens, but they don't necessarily line up like these do. For example, Jesus has the seven I am statements, but they don't start until chapter 6. And so they get stacked up. You have three of them in chapters 7 through 10. They don't fit. They don't align with the sections or the feasts or the signs. You have some who say that there are seven discourses, and they start somewhere down in here as well. I don't understand how you can say that John only has seven discourses, because when you look at that list, it doesn't include his discourse with Nicodemus. It doesn't include his discourse with the woman at the well. It doesn't include his discourses with the Jewish leadership at the temple grounds or at the Pool of Siloam. There's more than seven discourses. I don't even worry about that one. That's not one of John's sevens. The other thing that I would do differently, now that I've gone all the way through it with you, I would want to emphasize much more the extent to which John is pushing the idea that Jesus is the new temple. He not only has all sorts of temple imagery and temple symbolism in what Jesus says and what Jesus does, but he also extends that back prior to the temple to include the tabernacle, and he extends it back prior to the tabernacle. What was prior to the tabernacle? You had the temple. Before that, you had the tabernacle. Before the tabernacle, you had Jesus' appearance where the tabernacle would end up being set up, his appearance to Jacob at Bethel. And John even reaches back to that in Jesus' encounter with Nathanael in the calling of the disciples and says, here is an Israelite in whom there is no guile, as opposed to Jacob, who was the deceiver, and you will see the Son of Man, angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man, an obvious reference to Jacob's vision of the ladder to heaven. And he's saying that he is the fulfillment of the promises of what Jacob saw at Bethel. So John really pushes this idea. Bethel to tabernacle to temple to Jesus. Those are the focuses of God's presence to his people. Bethel the place, the moving tabernacle, which is awfully important to us now theologically as a moving and mobile church across the globe, the temple, and now Jesus himself. And if you would like to say, Eric, don't forget there were two temples, I'll push back a little bit on that idea, and I've said this before in this class too. Yes, there were two temples. Solomon's temple was destroyed. The second temple was built. But there is no description of the glory of Yahweh inhabiting the second temple. And the promises throughout the restoration passages of the prophets in the Old Testament talk about the glory of God returning to the temple. The glory of God never returned to that second temple. We don't see the glory of God returning until it comes and rests upon Jesus at his baptism. And that is the restoration of the glory of God to the temple, the new temple, the temple that is Jesus Christ. And by extension, I'm always obligated to say this, by extension, through our substantial union with him in baptism, the resting and settling of the glory of God upon every one of us who believe. We are the new temple because we are Christ. We are joined with him, and therefore we are also the new temple. And all of that language is spattered through the entire New Testament, and that might even be the next class I teach come September. I don't know yet. But those are the things I would change. And we're out of time. Next week, we pull up all the planks off the stage, and we look underneath, and we go, oh, that's interesting the way they built that. And look at the numbers and the numerology of John. With a whole lot of cautionary drawing of boundaries before we get into it. It'll be a full hour next week, but an interesting one. Interesting because it's very counter to the way we think in the 21st century West. Any final thoughts or questions for today? Helmer.
I agree that God did not inhabit the second temple. When Jesus did the cleansing of the temple, he said that you've turned my father's house into a den of lions or a den of thieves or whatever.
Yes, he did.
God still took ownership of the second temple even though he wasn't resident there.
Jesus clearly acknowledges that the Torah was being fulfilled at the second temple, that the rituals were being performed, that it was playing the role of the temple among the people. There's no question. He talks about it as his father's house. I mean, he's quoting the Old Testament there, but he's applying it to that second temple. So yeah, it's not that the second temple was nothing. My only point is that the Shekinah glory of God never came and inhabited it the way it did at Bethel, in the glory of Jacob's vision, the way it filled the tabernacle so that nobody could stand to be there. It drove everybody out, the smoke and the glory. And the same thing happened in Solomon's temple when they dedicated it and the glory of God came and indwelt the Holy of Holies. That never happens at the second temple. It doesn't delegitimize the temple in the functioning of Judaism any more than the synagogues that rose during the period of the exile are just dismissed. They're not. Jesus taught in the synagogues. Jesus used the synagogues. He absolutely embraces them as part of Judaism of his day. And he does the second temple as well. But the glory of God never lived in that building. Anything else? All right, let's pray. Father, thank you for the study of this book. Thank you for the lessons for all of us, for me as much as anyone. And I say it many times, but it's just so much of what I really hope is happening here, that the insights we gain wouldn't just be insights for us to say, what a cool book, but insights that would actually strengthen us as servants in your kingdom. And I pray that in Jesus' name. Amen.